Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, please bring your seats into the upright and locked position. Make sure your tray tables are stowed because we are about to take off. And we're going to be moving quickly today on Theology Thursday. We've got Pastor Chad Harvey will be back here in the studio next Thursday. Pastor Chad Harvey, RFA Church here in Raleigh, North Carolina, has been on a couple times in the last couple months. A great theologian, great preacher. And so next week we're going to do Theology Thursday about God's providence. It's an interesting topic, especially in the season that we're in. God's providence, and how do we deal with that? Is God in control of everything? What about free will? How do we kind of manage all of that? How do we think about that? God's plan versus our plan. What's going on in America? Who's the president? Who isn't the president? What happens in our culture? What doesn't happen? And how do you kind of mingle all that into God's providence? So we're going to do that next week on Theology Thursday. And then after that, we're planning 2 weeks in a row on Theology Thursday of end times theology. Eschatology, if you want to use a kind of a fancy seminary type word, but end times theology. And we're going to look at the different schools of thought there. And then this theologian that I'm going to have on actually is going to take a position that hasn't been real popular for the last 100 years, but used to be the norm. And asking the question, kind of, at what point does the rapture happen? Does the church, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, do we go through any period of the tribulation? Are we going to experience some of that, the great tribulation? What happens with the rapture of the church? What's the great and terrible day of the Lord? All of those things. So we're going to do a couple weeks in a row on Theology Thursday of end times theology, otherwise known as eschatology. But today I'm in teacher mode. I've been teaching all day. High school homeschoolers, and I've taught a class called Foundations of Freedom for the last 8 years, which is a civics and constitution class. And right now in my classes, three of my five classes are that. The other two classes are Christian ethics. And right now we're breaking into this conversation, and I'm teaching them through kind of the theology of America's founding, which starts with that question that we've been asking for years, is America a Christian nation? And of course, sometimes you go, well, it depends on what you mean by Christian and nation. What does that mean? Who's asking the question? And we tend to come down on one side or the other when it comes to the theology of America's founding. And that's what we're talking about today on the show. So either people go too far away from it and they say all the founding fathers were just a bunch of deists. They really weren't that religious. They certainly weren't a bunch of Bible thumpers, and you guys are all dreaming. You guys on the right, you Bible thumpers are all dreaming, thinking that the founding fathers were a flock of a bunch of really intense, committed Jesus followers. So that's one mistake, which is terribly inaccurate. But on the other end, sometimes, and I think David Barton, who I respect and look up to in many different ways, in some ways, I think he goes too far. Like, he wrote a whole book on Thomas Jefferson being a Christian. Just because Thomas Jefferson said he was a Christian doesn't mean he was a Christian. Because did you know that Thomas Jefferson, well, here's a couple of problems, didn't believe Jesus was virgin born, didn't believe that he rose from the grave, didn't believe that he was actually a deity, a member of the Trinity, didn't believe in any of Jesus' miracles. So you throw all that stuff out, you can call yourself a Christian, but are you really? But that's just one example, okay? Thomas Jefferson. So either we tend to deify, in many ways, the founding fathers, or we tend to turn them into just a bunch of deists or agnostics, which is remarkably inaccurate. So I'm going to run you through in the course of the show kind of the theology of our founding fathers. So here's a great quote. This is Theodore Roosevelt. Okay, this is fascinating. Around 1901, Theodore Roosevelt said, "Every thinking man, when he thinks, realizes that the teachings of the Bible are so interwoven and entwined with our whole civic and social life that it would be literally, and I do not mean figuratively, but literally impossible for us to figure what that loss would be if these teachings were removed." That was Theodore Roosevelt in 1901, talking about the Bible, the teachings of the Bible, and the fabric of American life, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, what it means to be America, that they're so interwoven that you literally can't even figure out what it would look like to try to take that cake apart Okay, so this is that's a fascinating conversation from Theodore Roosevelt, a great quote from 1901. So if we're going to understand the theology of America's founding, we actually don't start in 1776. We don't start in the Great Awakening, although we'll talk about that. We have to go all the way back to the Reformation, before America was America, even before the Puritans, otherwise known as Pilgrims, came here. You got to go all the way back to the Reformation, all the way back to 1517. Okay, what was going on there? Martin Luther obviously had a problem with the Catholic Church, had a problem with indulgences, posted his 95 Theses to the wall. And so this was the birth of Protestantism, but it was also the birth, or perhaps rebirth, of religious liberty. Because what happened is conflict then arose across Europe as the Catholics and the Protestants clashed, as Protestantism grew, and life got to be really hard for those outside the Catholic Church. Okay? In the meantime, this is all set in motion when the Reformation started in 1517. In the meantime, the New World is discovered. Okay, this on the other side of the pond, across the Atlantic, there's this what looks to be an incredible place where people could move to and start a new life. And so you go forward as a way to escape religious persecution. That's why they went. So when you look at the original Puritan settlers, which we call the Pilgrims, right? You get all that vision in your head. And I do this with my students. I'm like, I say Pilgrims, what do you think of? Well, they have the big crazy hat with the big buckle on it. They got a big belt buckle. They wear brown and white and black, and they have their big Thanksgiving feast and all that. So we tend to look at them in a very kind of a limited way. But what they actually were absolutely, they were religious separatists. They opposed worldliness. They opposed weakness in the church in England. And they're like, we just want to be able to worship free of persecution, free of the power of the Catholic Church. We just want religious freedom. And so we're going to move. We're going to risk our lives. And we're going to sail across the Atlantic in order to escape worldliness and weakness in the church, and in order to find true religious freedom. That's why they came. That's who came here first. So you had two different Americas. You had the New York Times version, 1619, down in Jamestown, and that was debaucherous and nasty. But then you go north, and you get the Pilgrims, who are Puritans, and they're here on December 26th of 1620, right? And so the Mayflower Compact was a big deal back then. How are we going to govern ourselves? The Mayflower Compact establishes a temporary government, and God had an agreement with his people. His people had an agreement with each other. And you know what we call that? That's a social contract. That's government by the consent of the governed. Doesn't that sound familiar? We'll pick it up there when we come back. Okay, welcome back. We're moving fast today. Theology Thursday, looking at the theology of America's founding fathers. And you got to look at a bunch of different things there. And I'm taking you through the material that I teach to high school age homeschoolers. I wanted to teach this class actually for adults this fall, but things are so crazy and trying to find a place and then restrictions and all that stuff. So I shelved that idea here in Raleigh for the fall. I still want to do it in the spring. So if I can do it in the spring, if we can find a place, if we're on the other side of this COVID stuff, the country's still standing, then I would love to find a location, it might be a church or something other thing like that, and then condense a two-semester course, which is one and a half hour class a week, but essentially a two-semester course into one semester and one night a week. That's what I want to do. And condense it down, because I want to have more time for conversation and kind of back and forth with a bunch of adults in the room. That'll be necessary and beneficial. So I want to do that in the spring, so I'll let you know. But today, just giving you, we're drilling down on just one aspect of all these things that I teach and have been taught for years. When we look at the theology of America, the theology of America's founding, how much of a role did Christianity play? So we started in 1517 with the Reformation, the tradition of dissent, where there's a persecution led to a drive for religious liberty, which is why the Pilgrims came over here. They were Puritans. They were religious separatists. That's why they came. That started. Okay, that's what was first. Then you had Jamestown, which was south. That's what the New York Times tried to do with their 1619 thing. They go to Jamestown, which was debaucherous, saying the whole country is founded on nothing but slavery, which is a lie. Was it there? Yes. Was it significant? Yes. But to say that's the backbone of it is ridiculous. Just, it's inept and a lie. Okay, so Puritans, okay, here they are. So what did they say? Listen to this. This is fascinating. John Winthrop, the first governor, all the way back in the 1600s, okay, late 1620s. We shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. So that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. That's John Winthrop, the governor. They're that first group of people in the late 1620s. Okay? What does that sound like to you? City on a hill, where'd that come from? And what God do you think they're talking about? This is rich in biblical language because these people were serious, hardcore Puritan Christians, okay? And they saw this as a mission field, that they're going to be an example of Christianity to a watching world here in the New World. And if we've undertaken and so caused him to withdraw his present help from us, God, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. We'll be a joke. So they were all about glorifying God and religious freedom when they came here. That's the foundation. That's the soil out of which the rest of this story comes. Okay, it's so important to remember that. And then look at something like, tell me if this could get passed today. The Old Deluder Satan Act of 1647. Could you imagine that? Hey, Governor Cooper, we have an idea down here in the legislature here in North Carolina. We want to pass the Old Deluder Satan Act. What? What is that? That was an actual law passed in 1647. So if you have houses and churches and schools showing up in your city, if your little town's getting big enough, only 1647, okay? We're not that far into the American experiment. That if you have enough people coming out, then you got to build a school. And you got to build a school because your people have to learn how to read. And they have to be able to read because they need to be able to, as your society grows, they need to be able to read the Bible. Right. They need to be able to read the Bible. So this was built, this is the DNA out of which our country is growing. That you have to understand the Bible if you're going to have a society because your people have to have morals and they have to have a religious underpinning. That being Christianity. Okay. So they're teaching reading to kids. And you remember, have you ever seen this? The New England Primer. This is what they were, check this out. They were using this for first through fourth graders in the mid-1600s here in the New World. The New England Primer. These are the words. Check this out. These are the words that they're teaching to first through fourth graders. Accompany, benevolence, ceremony, discontented, everlasting, fidelity, glorifying, humility, infirmity, admiration, beneficial, consolation, declaration, exhortation, fornication, generation, habitation, invitation. First to fourth grade, right? That's college level stuff today. Then you flip the page and they have some pictures. Now check out the theology that they're teaching in these pictures as you learn the ABCs. A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. Okay, that'll preach. B, thy life to men, this book, capital B, attend. Picture of a book. What book do you think that is, class? That's right, the Bible. C, the cat doth play and after slay. I'm hoping that means kill cats, but we'll save that for another day. E, an eagle's flight is out of sight. F, the idle fool is whipped at school. I'm like, yeah, I like that one. Okay, here's some other ones. As runs the glass, man's life does pass. Think theology. My book and heart shall never part. What book are they talking about? The Bible. Job feels the rod and blesses God. This is what they're teaching in first through fourth grade. Job feels the rod and blesses God. Do you remember what Job said? Though he slay me, still I will trust in him. Great theology at the youngest age. The lion bold, the lamb doth hold. That's going on in first through fourth grade in the mid-1600s. Then we start to create colleges. That doesn't take long either in the late 1600s. So these are all, I'm going to just share with you some Ivy League mottos. These are from the late 1600s, the most liberal schools in America today. Check this out. Brown University. What's their motto at the time? In God we hope. Columbia University. In thy light shall we see the light. Princeton University, under God's power, she flourishes. University of Pennsylvania, laws without morals are useless. Yale University, light and truth. Harvard, check this out. Harvard University, 1646, rules and precepts. Everyone shall consider the main end of his life and studies to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life. Seeing the Lord giveth wisdom, everyone shall seriously by prayer in secret seek wisdom of him. That's Harvard. Rules and Precepts, 1646. So, as you move forward in time, these are the educational institutions from first grade all the way through college, absolutely inculcated with a biblical view and teaching the Bible and Bible theology. Okay? Absolutely. So, who comes through that system? Well, that would be the founding fathers. That's how they're being raised. Okay? From the late 1600s into the 1700s, but then things started to slip a little in the mid-1700s. We'll talk about that next with the Great Awakening. But then people point to like somebody like Benjamin Franklin. And they'll go, oh, Benjamin Franklin, he was just a deist. That's God creates everything, winds it up, and then goes on vacation to Tahiti and the other part of the universe. He doesn't have any personal involvement. That's a deist. Okay? And people like to say that want to say, hey, Christianity didn't have much to do with the country. Look at Benjamin Franklin. He was a deist. Oh, really? Let me read to you what Benjamin Franklin said in front of the assembly when they're talking about the Constitution. In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for the divine protection, capital D, capital P. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. And have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. That means he's not a deist. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground, that's in the Bible, without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Gosh, where did he get that? That sounds familiar to me. I firmly believe, Benjamin Franklin said, this. And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth, prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of this city be requested to officiate in that service. Oh, but Steve, what about the separation of church and state? Doesn't exist. Benjamin Franklin, deist at the Constitutional Convention. That's part of the theology of America's founding. We'll be right back. Is America a Christian nation? Is it a Christian nation? There's 330 million people here. Are 330 million of them Christians? Of course not. Is the founding, are the founding fathers Christians? Well, mostly, and it depends on how you define Christian. Is the Declaration of Independence a Christian document? Well, it was heavily influenced by a Christian worldview, by a biblical worldview. I'd say on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being God wrote it himself, and 1 being there's nothing Christian about the document whatsoever. I'd say it's a 6 or a 7. Christian influence on the Declaration of Independence. Is God mentioned in the, how many times is God mentioned in the U.S. Constitution? God, capital G, creator, capital C. How many times is that? How many times do you see that in the U.S. Constitution? That would be 0. However, there's a lot about our form of governance that relies on, came out of a strong biblical worldview, not the least of which is the doctrine of sin, human depravity, our tendency to do bad things. That we're kind of bent towards sin, which is why Lord Acton said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So no way are we going to centralize too much power. So we're going to have three branches. We're going to have federalism. We're going to have a federal government that we're going to try to keep small. And then we're going to allow a lot of room to run for the state governments, a lot of independence there. So federalism and three branches of government and checks and balances and all that kind of stuff. Our founding fathers were great students of history. They looked at democracy as it was given birth in Athens and in Rome. They looked at it through the Middle Ages. They looked at the feudal system. What worked? What didn't work? Do we want a pure democracy? You do not. You don't want a regular democracy because that's just majority rules. And who's going to protect the minority in that deal? Nobody. By the way, why would you even care about the minority? Well, that's based on human dignity and the image of God, which is biblical. That's God's truth. And that informed our founding fathers as they were raised in that. And when they established our form of government, a representative republic, a democratic republic, it takes all that into account. So Christianity, a Christian worldview, Judeo-Christian worldview, is the soil out of which a lot of most of this stuff comes, okay? But it takes a conversation. That's why it takes me a couple of weeks to teach this in my classes. Today, I'm dumping it all on you in one-hour show, which means 40 minutes of talk time on the radio. Okay, so we started in the 1500s with the Reformation. We went into the 1620s, and now you've got the Puritans coming over. Now we push through the end of the 1600s. You see what all of their college institutions, the Ivy League schools today, back then, were very Christ-centered, very biblical-centered. Of course, they went off the rails since then. That's a whole other story for another day. Then we're pushing into the 1700s. We're trying to get ourselves to 1776 and then to 1787 and 1789. 1776, the Declaration of Independence, the start of the War for Independence. 1787, when we came together in the Constitutional Convention to write the Constitution. 1789, when it was ratified. Okay? That's what we're doing here. So we're working ourselves through the timeline in order to understand what's the theology of America's founding. Okay? That's what I'm doing here today on Theology Thursday. So we come through that. They're being educated. First grade through fourth grade, incredible vocabulary, incredible theology. Colleges are all bent around a Christian worldview. Then things start to decline. Okay, a lot of materialism, rationalism, Enlightenment thinking. We're pretty smart. We can figure this out. We don't need God. We don't need the Bible. Enlightenment's in there. It's coming over from Europe. So that's impacting life in America. Then that brings us to 1734, which was the beginning of the First Great Awakening. Have you ever heard of Jonathan Edwards? Remember that name? Sinners in the hands of a angry God, right? Not exactly a seeker-sensitive method or message. But Jonathan Edwards just starts preaching this thing over and over again. And like entire little towns are falling down over themselves because of their sin. It's a brutal message. Essentially, if you don't know God, if you're not in Christ, if you're lost, you are in the hands of an angry God. He's angry at you because of your sin. And you're like a spider at the end of a spider web, and God is dangling you over the fires of hell. The only thing separating you from the fires of hell at any given moment is the patience and the grace of an angry God. Okay? That's the story. Not exact. Try that one this Sunday at your church. See what happens. But he starts preaching that, and Great Awakening, the awakening breaks out. And people are getting converted and coming to Christ, changing entire towns. Then George Whitefield comes over, the great British evangelist. He preached from New England down to Georgia. He did 7 tours of America, and he hammered sin, but he also hammered the preachers. Listen to what he said. I am verily persuaded, this is George Whitefield, I am verily persuaded the generality of preachers, here in America he's talking about, talk of an unknown, unfelt Christ. And the reason why congregations have been so dead is because dead men preach to them. Whoa, shots fired, right? George Whitefield comes over, preaching the gospel and laying waste to a compromised priesthood, pastors. Hey, your congregations are dead because your pastors are dead, right? Huge. And the Great Awakening breaks out. Do you think as the country was engaged in more Enlightenment thinking, materialism, rationalism in the 1730s, do you think a divided secular nation would be ready in 1776 to declare war against the world's lone superpower? No, not even possible. You cannot get the American Revolution done or even engaged in without the First Great Awakening. Without the First Great Awakening, you got nothing. You got nothing to work with. And America probably wouldn't exist. But it did happen. And there was a huge impact. Church membership increased. There's increased missionary activity. Indians and frontiersmen were being reached. Dartmouth College was started in 1754, specifically for Indians that were becoming Christians and for missionaries that were going to the Indians. Then a guy named David Brainerd, who was a missionary to the Indians, published his diary. It was like a bestseller back then. Man, God was doing some things here. The awakening impacted higher education. Princeton was established in 1746. Now, this is fascinating. At Princeton, okay? At Princeton, you had some people that came there to start teaching. And you had somebody that wrote a good chunk of the Constitution, went there as a student. So I'm going to get to that. Okay, so the Great Awakening's happening. That's awesome. 1766 and 1775, now Great Britain starts to flex its muscles. King George III's coming to power. He's like, yeah, you guys have had it too easy for too long. You guys are doing well. You're making a lot of money over there in the colonies. We need a little more of that action. And so you get the Stamp Act, the Townshend Act. That was where we got taxation without representation, by the way. It wasn't the size of the tax, or like at the Tea Party in Boston, it wasn't the size of the tax. It was taxation without representation, which is the problem. So we're losing, under King George III, who started to reassert the power of the crown, we're losing our political liberty, which for an astute pastorate here in America and astute Americans who were educated well in the Bible, saw that if you lose your political liberty, friends, what else are you going to lose? The very thing that brought the Puritans here in the first place, religious liberty. If we lose our political liberty, that means we're going to lose our religious liberty. And them are fighting words. 1774, the Quebec Act on behalf of the French settlers in Canada, privileged status to Roman Catholicism, and they're worried now, oh boys, are we going to start running into the problem that they have in England and in Europe, where all of a sudden the church is totally in bed with the governments, and yeah, that's a problem. So things are steaming up, right? Parliament passes the Intolerable Acts. They close Boston Harbor. They nullify the Massachusetts Charter of Government. There's peacetime quartering of British soldiers, which means they can show up at your house and say, what's for dinner? You have to take them in and take care of them. This place is getting bad fast. Threats to liberty then begin to sound from the pulpits with our patriot pastors. Chief among them is the Virginia pastor Peter Muhlenberg. In 1776, this is what he said. There is a time to preach and a time to pray, but there is also a time to fight. And that time has come. Right out of Ecclesiastes. Time for peace and time for war. Right? Muhlenberg, by the way, became a major general who served under George Washington. A pastor. Then you got Reverend John Witherspoon. This is going to tie us back to Princeton. Reverend John Witherspoon was the president of the college at New Jersey at Princeton, who taught James Madison. It's a great little thread to pull on here. Witherspoon teaches James Madison. And Witherspoon was in the Continental Congress, and was also a signer of the Declaration of Independence. But what about James Madison? James Madison, and they called him the old doctor, John Witherspoon. Witherspoon became like his mentor at Princeton. Witherspoon emphasized the gospel. He's introducing students like James Madison to great political thinkers like John Locke and Montesquieu. And John Locke, by the way, the number one political influencer of all the founding fathers in terms of his writings, and specifically in terms of for Thomas Jefferson. The number one political influence, political philosopher for Jefferson and the founding fathers was John Locke. You go read John Locke's stuff. That guy was a hardcore, committed, serious Christian. Unbelievable. I mean, he wrote entire commentaries on the book of Romans. The guy was unbelievable. So what's Witherspoon teaching James Madison? That God is sovereign. He's the source of all law. The created universe with physical laws to maintain the cosmic order and created man under the natural law to maintain moral order. That's where we get that phrase that you probably know. The law of nature and nature's God, right? You see all this stuff getting baked into the cake? All this is going into our founding fathers. Then they're able to fight a revolutionary war and win it, okay? So Madison himself, James Madison, when you read his writings, I wouldn't describe him as an evangelical. But he definitely had a rock-solid biblical worldview, and his context was dictated by what he had learned, his understanding of man and government. That's why Madison said the Constitution recognized, get this, a degree of depravity in mankind which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust. Where did Madison get that? That's the doctrine of sin. That's Christianity. This is Steve Noble. We'll be right back. 'Cause you are more. All right, welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, Theology Thursday. Considering the theology of America's founding, is America a Christian nation? And we were just talking about this offline on Facebook Live. So if you want to join us here in the studio each day, you can do that on Facebook. Just go to the Steve Noble Show page on Facebook. And if you're like, hey, Steve, what's wrong with your voice? Well, this is like the fourth hour of teaching I've done today. So I'm getting to the end of my rope, but this is a part of the Constitution and Civics course that I've been teaching for 8 years for high school homeschoolers. I wanted to do one this fall for adults in the evening, like Tuesday or Thursday night here in Raleigh. We were going to Facebook Live that as well. There'll be a cost to it, you know, because we have starving kids that we need to feed. But with COVID and everything else, it's too much for this semester. So I definitely am going to reboot and try to do that coming in January. So if we do it, it would be one a week. It'd be about an hour and a half, maybe a 2-hour class once a week. And we do probably 14 or 15 weeks in a row where I would basically do my entire civics constitution class for you in one semester. We're going to leave more time for conversation because it's a bunch of adults in there. You guys are going to talk more than students do. But man, it is so fascinating, invigorating. It's a huge problem in our lives. I saw this article just the other day. Let me pull it up on my phone. I saw this article just the other day that was talking about most of us, this is in the NBCnews.com, most of us would fail the U.S. citizenship test, survey finds. An embarrassment, says the president of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, which conducted the survey. Think you know your U.S. history and government? Then why does the flag have 13 stripes? What are the three branches of government? Who did the United States fight in World War II? I know what you're thinking. Oh, that's easy. A new poll shows that only a little over a third of Americans would pass a basic multiple-choice U.S. citizenship test modeled after the one taken by immigrants in the process of naturalization. The survey, released October 3rd, last fall, by the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, sampled 1,000 American adults. It showed that only 36% actually passed the test. Respondents 65 and older scored the best, 74%, while only 19% of test takers 45 and younger passed. 19%! 45 and younger. So they include people 35 up to 45. But if we go under 35, I bet it's 10% at best. We have a massive, massive disconnect in this country. Massive ignorance about civics, the Constitution, and what I'm taking you through today, the Christian influence, strong, observable, provable Christian influence on the founding of this nation. Not just the Declaration of Independence, but in a lot of elements of the Constitution itself, which flowed and came out of the soil of a Christian worldview. And most people are just clueless. The survey asked about everything from important dates to historical figures and current events. Only 13% knew when the U.S. Constitution was written. What year? Do you know? What year was it written? It's a trick question, really. It's the year it was written, then it's the year it was ratified. It was written during the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Then it took into 1789 for it to get ratified. They needed at least 9 out of the 13 colonies, okay? More than half of those surveyed did not know which countries the U.S. fought against in World War II. And you wonder why our young people are flirting with socialism. 57% didn't know how many justices are on the Supreme Court. Do you? I bet you do. All right, trick question. All right, trick question. How many justices does the Constitution say are supposed to be on the U.S. Supreme Court? How many justices does the Constitution say are supposed to be on the U.S. Supreme Court? I'm just throwing this out one for my friends on Facebook Live. We'll see what you guys do. Okay? How many justices did the United States Constitution say are supposed to be on the U.S. Supreme Court? And do you know how many we have today? How many? How many? I bet you know this, right? 9. But what does the Constitution say? What does the Constitution say about how many justices there are supposed to be on the U.S. Supreme Court? Do you want the answer? Nothing. The U.S. Constitution says nothing about how many justices are on the U.S. Supreme Court. Zero. Zip. Nada. That just became kind of a number. Then you go 33. Would 33 make sense? No, that's too many. Would 3 make sense? Well, it kind of acts like that. But no, that doesn't make any sense either. Let me ask you another question. Do you know how many amendments there are to the U.S. Constitution? Do you? How many amendments? How many amendments are there to the U.S. Constitution? How many? I know there's at least 10, Steve. Right. What do we call those, the first 10? Correct. Bill of Rights. Good job. But how many are there total? 27. Do you, this is funny, some funny constitutional trivia. Do you know when the 27th Amendment was passed? Who was president when the 27th Amendment was passed? It's Bill Clinton. What was the 27th Amendment? The 27th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that by law, when the Congress votes for itself a pay raise, it cannot go into effect until after the next election. Great idea, right? Because if they voted themselves a pay raise, like right now, and then gave it to themselves next week, what are you going to do about that? They did it already. They go, hey, we're awesome. Let's give ourselves a 30% pay raise. And then boom, next week they enact it, right? You would have no repercussion. So this puts it on the other side of the election. They have to tell you before the next election, we're giving ourselves a 30% pay raise. And you'd be like, these dirtbags, I'm going to vote all of you out. But they wouldn't actually touch that until after the next election. See the beauty of that? All right. Under Clinton, that's when the 27th Amendment was actually finally passed. But when was it first put in? When did somebody suggest the contents of the 27th Amendment? Do you know? 1950? 1875? 1800? It was like 1791. It took 200 years to pass what would become the 27th Amendment. Because it was a great idea back then, but even back then, they didn't have the willpower to do it. They didn't want to check themselves. But the 27th Amendment was first brought up in the late 1700s and wasn't passed until the 1990s under Bill Clinton. Pretty funny, right? Nobody knows this stuff. Nobody. Which is why I teach it. Okay? And I'm finishing up this conversation with you. You're my class for the hour. So just a few more things. We were talking about James Madison, who wrote most of the Constitution. It was a collective thing, but Madison penned a lot of it. And Madison went to Princeton, where he was mentored by John Witherspoon. John Witherspoon, hardcore Christian, taught political philosophy using thinkers like John Locke and Montesquieu. John Locke, hardcore Christian, totally sold out Christian, amazing man. Go look up John Locke. It's amazing. And this is what he taught. God is sovereign and the source of all law. The created order, the created universe with physical laws to maintain cosmic order, and created man, God created man under the natural law to maintain moral order. That's where we got the phrase, the law of nature, and nature's God, right? Madison, when you look at his own writings, see what he said, see what he thought. I wouldn't describe him as an evangelical, but he definitely had a rock solid biblical worldview. And his context was dictated by what he had learned and the philosophies of not just Locke and Montesquieu, but Paul and James and Peter and Jesus and Moses and the prophets and Solomon. All of it's in there. Madison said the Constitution, this is what I finished with the last segment, the Constitution itself, which doesn't mention God, doesn't mention the Bible, doesn't mention Jesus, doesn't mention Creator, capital C. But Madison said that the Constitution recognized, quote, a degree of depravity in mankind which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust, unquote. What does that sound like? That is the doctrine of sin. That's what that is. Human depravity. Okay? That's all baked into the cake. So in the final analysis, as we look at the theology of America's founding, this is what I finished the class with. The final analysis. American society in the past was not completely Christian, but was largely God-fearing. God-fearing and immense respect for the Bible as the greatest source of wisdom on the planet. They weren't deists. They understood that God governed in the affairs of men. Biblical standards helped dictate public morals, judicial decisions, and social values. That's the soil out of which all these people came. There were three main impacts: personal liberty, the tradition of dissent, and the pervasive influence of Scripture. Personal liberty. Why does that matter? Because you're made in the image of God. You have inestimable worth. You have free will, self-determination, all underneath the banner of an overarching, powerful, judging, loving God. And then you got the tradition of dissent. That started with Martin Luther. When there's something wrong, when there's something immoral going on, you need to stand up against it for the good of mankind. The tradition of dissent. If you have a knowledge of something bad going on, you have a responsibility to act. What does that come out of? Love your neighbor as yourself. That's biblical to the core. And then the pervasive influence of Scripture. Starting in first grade, all the way through college. It was all over the place. When I wrote my research paper on the Declaration of Independence, I have a two-volume set of actual sermons preached by patriotic pastors in the colonies between 1730 and 1790. And these got circulated. These were some of the most, these would have been like the big podcasts of the day. And they're just thundering God's providence, the individual worth of mankind, equality. And that was flooding into the colonists' thinking and minds. And then Thomas Jefferson's job in writing the Declaration, which if you read what he said, Thomas Jefferson wasn't, I'm going to go lock myself in a room and write what I think. Thomas Jefferson's job in the Declaration of Independence was to distill the thinking of his fellow colonists. What's our rationale here? We're about to declare war against the greatest superpower on the planet. We better have a pretty good reason, and it better come from the ultimate authority. He was just reflecting back accurately what the American experience was in 1776, which was heavily influenced by a Judeo-Christian worldview. Unbelievable. Martin Luther, the Reformation, personal liberty. Man has access to God directly and therefore had certain unalienable rights that came from God rather than man. The Reformation fathered much of this kind of thinking behind American independence. So I would say the theology of America's founding is quite strong. And that should encourage you. But you got to know it to appreciate it. This is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon. And like my dad always used to say, ever forward.